This is Steve Kim. Welcome to the AC Podcast. On this podcast, we want to help you understand and speak the language of our culture and address questions being asked with intellectual honesty, gentleness, and respect. By the time you listen to this, Christmas will have already come and gone. A belated Merry Christmas to you all, and I hope you are all recovering from the turkey dinner coma, or whatever kind of dinner you had, really. As for me, I had more sugar than I care to admit, and I have zero regrets. I guess I'll see if I change my tune in the next few days or so. Like I promised in the last episode, we didn't want you left without an episode of the AC Podcast, so today I'm bringing you I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist from Frank Turek, his breakout session from the 2017 Apologetics Canada Conference. For many of you, Dr. Turek needs no introduction. If you like what you hear and want to listen to and watch more stuff, just go to our online store at apologeticscanada.com/store. Under the digital download section, you'll see all the recordings we have of our past conferences. That's hours and hours worth of material for affordable prices. Now, with that commercial out of the way, let's get to it. You're listening to I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist by Dr. Frank Turek. Dr. Turek is the author of Stealing from God, Why Atheists Need God to Make Their Case, and co-author of I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. He is the host of Cross-Examined with Frank Turek on American Family Radio and I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist on the NRB Network. This breakout session was recorded at the Apologetics Canada Conference on March 4th, 2017 at Northview Community Church in Abbotsford, British Columbia.
Howdy, gang. How many were here last night or were somewhere else at the time? All right, good. How many are here right now? That's what we really need to know. Okay, good. You guys got enough room over there? All right, good. Enough room over there. Thanks for being part of the presentation. All right. I got an email not long ago from a United States Marine. So I knew this man was no sissy. But he wasn't actually writing me as a tough guy. He was actually writing me as a distraught father. He said, my daughter was the top Christian student in her high school class. She won several scholarships from Christian organizations that she could take to any college she wanted to. And she wanted to go to the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill to win the campus for Christ. It needs to be won for Christ. Very liberal school. I just spoke there about a year and a half ago. It's about 3 hours from where I live in Charlotte, North Carolina. Anyway, this father said, I sent my daughter off there, and 4 weeks into her first semester, I got a phone call from her. Her words devastated me. She said, Dad, I don't believe in God anymore. Don't believe in God anymore? What? He said, I got in my car. I drove 4 hours down to Chapel Hill that weekend. I sat down with her and I got nowhere with her. I said, what do you mean you don't believe in God anymore? What happened? And she said, we have an atheist professor who teaches the New Testament class here at Chapel Hill. Yeah, the atheists teach those classes. And he said, we don't even know who wrote the Gospels and the Bible has errors in it. So, Dad, I'm an atheist now. Now, ladies and gentlemen, do you think that this woman, actually, that's not her, but you get the idea. Do you think that this young woman in 4 weeks investigated all the evidence for and against Christianity and made a rational decision it was false? No, you couldn't do that in 4 weeks. What happened instead? What happened is she went off to the college unarmed. She didn't have any real evidence that Christianity was true. And then she heard an argument or two which could be construed as against Christianity, and she left. What's the easiest way to get picked off in a war? It's to not know you're in one. And I think you've already figured it out because you're a sophisticated crowd, but we're in a war for the hearts and minds of not just our young people, but the hearts and minds of everyone. The world isn't neutral out there. The world is going to pull you away from Christian truth and try and indoctrinate you into a new religion, a new faith. You know why our kids and others aren't really good at defending the faith is we haven't lived up to 1 Peter 3:15, which says, always be ready to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have, but do this with gentleness and respect. Now, the gentleness and respect thing is hard for me because I'm originally from New Jersey. Okay? But we're supposed to give a reason for the hope that we have. And it's not that difficult to do. You only need to answer four questions in the affirmative to show that Christianity is true. In other words, if you investigate these four questions, I think you'll realize that the answer to these four questions is yes. And if the answer to these four questions is yes, then Christianity is true. What are the four questions? Here are the four questions. Now that is some pretty grooving music, isn't it? That's right. That is actually from our TV show, which you don't get in Canada. Oh, Canada. But it is on Roku. If you have Roku, channel, it's the NRB TV on Roku. It's also on the internet at our website there, crossexamine.org. We're also on radio every Saturday morning, but it's not on in Canada. That's okay. You can listen to it online, or you can listen to it on our app or in podcasts. And what we do is we present evidence for Christianity and we cross-examine ideas against it. Now, why are these the four questions? Truth, God, miracles, and the New Testament. Let's handle these individually. Does truth exist? You have to deal with that question. Why? Because if the culture's right, you know, where they say there is no truth, or you got your truth, or all truth is relative, then quite obviously the Bible can't be true. Of course, if there is no truth, then any book written by an atheist can't be true either. Right? We'll deal with that question first. Second question, does God exist? You can't have a word from God if there's no God. I hope to show you today that there really is a theistic God. What's a theistic God? A spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful, moral, personal, intelligent creator who created all things and sustains all things. We'll look at three arguments very briefly for this God. Third question, are miracles possible? Obviously, the Bible can't be true if miracles are not possible. But I hope to show you today that not only are miracles possible, but the greatest miracle in the Bible has already occurred, and we have scientific evidence for it. Then we can look at the key question, is the New Testament true? The New Testament doesn't have a prayer if there's no truth, no God, or no miracles. But if truth exists, God exists, and miracles are possible, then we can see if the miracles in the New Testament, particularly the resurrection, really did occur. Or were the documents that say it occurred written down by religious zealots who embellished it and made it up? Now some of you are looking at that going, wait a minute, Frank. Do you believe in the Old Testament? Well, look, if the New Testament's reliable, you get the Old Testament thrown in. Why? Who's in the New Testament that can authenticate the Old Testament? Jesus, right? Now, whenever you're in Sunday school, you don't know the answer, just say Jesus. You'll probably be right, okay? Yes. Yes, Jesus. If Jesus really is God, as the New Testament documents claim he is, now that's a big if, but if he really is God, whatever God teaches is true. Jesus taught the entire Old Testament as the Word of God. So if the New Testament is just reliable, you get the Old Testament thrown in. Now, the book goes into a lot more detail than just that. So if you want to go more, you can go into it more. I think the book's available out there. There's a DVD set and a curriculum you can get on our website. And if you want this PowerPoint presentation I'm about to show you, in fact, I can't show you all the slides, we don't have enough time, but if you want the entire PowerPoint presentation in a PDF form, type that into your browser, crossexamine.org/FF for Fearless Faith. That's another program we run. And if you send me an email, I'm going to send you this PowerPoint presentation plus some other resources you can use for free. But you need to type that into your browser. It's not going to be a spot on our website or link. You've got to type that in, all right? So we're going to go through these four questions very quickly. We only have like 36 minutes to do this. So I'm going to speak a little bit more quickly than I have been, okay? You guys ready to go? All right, here we go. Let's start here at point one. Does truth exist? And whenever you start talking about truth, you always have to start with Jack Nicholson. Right? Because Tom Cruise had him on the witness stand, and he said to him, Colonel, I want the truth. And Nicholson said,
you can't handle the truth.
Abbotsford. If he said it that way, the movie would have gone nowhere. All right? Can we try that again? Colonel, I want the truth. All right, there's a lot of people out there that can't handle the truth. They're saying, you got your truth, I got my truth, there is no truth, all truth is relative. If you don't get anything else out of what we talk about here today, if you just get this one idea down, it's going to be worth your time. In fact, this is the most important thinking skill I've ever learned. And I didn't learn it until I was 33 years old in seminary. I already had a master's degree and I didn't know what I'm about to tell you now. And it's the most important thinking skill you'll ever learn. You'll become a fearless apologist if you learn this thinking skill. In fact, when I came through the border yesterday, the guy at the gate, you know, the customs agent said, where are you going? I said, I'm going to an apologetics conference. He said, a what? I'm not saying I'm sorry. I'm there to say that God exists and Jesus rose from the dead. He went, okay. And if you get good at this thinking skill, as I say, you're going to be a fearless apologist. Half of what you know is in this one skill. Here's the skill. It's best illustrated by example. If someone were to ever say to you, there is no truth, you should ask that person a question. What should the question be? Is that true? Is it true that there is no truth? Because if it's true that there is no truth, the claim there is no truth can't be true, but it claims to be true. Did I say that right? I know that can give you intellectual constipation if you think about it long enough. But that's because it's self-defeating. It doesn't meet its own standard. Now, what's the thinking skill? The thinking skill here is you need to turn the claim on itself. Turn the claim on itself to see if it meets its own standard. And if you do that, you'll realize it doesn't. A self-defeating statement doesn't meet its own standard. Like, for example, if I were to say, I can't speak a word in English, what would you say? You just did. If I were to say, my parents had no kids that lived, what would you say? See, this is self-defeating. Or my brother is an only child. My son has his favorite self-defeating statement is this. This will take a minute to get, but you'll get it if you think about it. He said, Hitler wasn't such a bad guy. After all, he killed Hitler. Some of you will get that tomorrow, okay? These are known as self-defeating statements. And the key here is to turn the claim on itself. Now, there are many of these in our culture. If somebody says all truth is relative, you're going to turn the claim on itself and say what? Is that a relative truth? If somebody says there are no absolutes, what are you going to say? Are you absolutely sure? If somebody says you can't know anything, what are you going to say? Then how do you know that? If somebody says you should doubt everything, what are you going to say? Should I doubt that? Why are skeptics skeptical of everything but skepticism? All right, now how many people in here have doubts? I don't care if you're an atheist or a Christian or anyone in between. How many times? Hey, I have doubts. Sometimes I wake up in the morning and I go, I don't even know if this stuff is true. You ever do that? But I realize most of the time when I'm doubting, it's not intellectual, it's emotional. In other words, the evidence is quite good for Christianity. What's changing is me. If I'm having a good day, everything's fine. Bad day, I don't even know if this stuff's true. Good day, everything's fine. Bad day, I don't even know this stuff. You ever do that? Now what's changing? Is the evidence changing or am I changing? I'm changing. I'm going up and down. In fact, my friend Greg Kokel says it this way. He says, and he's a Christian apologist. He says, before I have my first cup of coffee in the morning, I'm an atheist. After I have my first cup, I'm a Jehovah's Witness. By the time I have my second cup, I'm back to being a Christian. What's changed? Him? No. Or if the evidence hasn't changed, he's changed. How about you ought not judge? You hear that all the time. What's the problem with that? It's a judgment. Next time somebody says you ought not judge, say, then why are you judging me for judging? See, by the way, Jesus didn't say don't judge. He said judge not, lest you be judged. He tells you to take the speck out of your brother's eye. That involves making a judgment. He simply says, get the log out of your own eye first so you can better help your brother. So it's not a command not to judge. It's a command on how to judge. Everybody makes judgments. Atheists make judgments. What judgments do they make? Well, there is no God. The Bible's wrong. You're wrong. Those are all judgments. You made 1,000 judgments today. between good and evil, safe choices from dangerous choices. You'd be dead if you didn't make judgments. Don't buy into this idea you can't make judgments. And Jesus was pretty firm in making judgments. You don't think so? Just go read Matthew chapter 23. What does he say in there? What are you scribes and Pharisees, you hypocrites? He's going after the politicians of his day. You strain out a gnat and swallow a camel. Oh, you look great on the outside. You're whitewashed tombs, but on the inside, you're full of dead men's bones. You go a mile to make a convert, then once you make them a convert, you make them twice as much a son of hell as you are. How will you avoid being condemned to hell? What? Sweet and gentle Jesus said this? Yes, Jesus was not Barney. Can't we all get along, boys and girls? No! He was not Mr. Rogers. Can you say kindness, boys and girls? I mean, he was kind most of the time, but he didn't certainly go around saying, this sermon brought to you by the letter P. No, Jesus was tough. Sometimes you got to be tough and just say it straight out. By the way, I've noticed one other thing about judging. You ever notice that when you compliment somebody, which is a judgment, nobody gets upset? Like if you say to your best friend, you know, I really love you. You're such a wonderful person. You think your best friend's going to go, who do you think you are? You judging me? You think you're worse than me? No, never going to say that. Why? See, people don't have a problem with judging. They just have a problem with judgments they don't like. And if you say something that's true to someone in a nice way and they're upset, you just help convict them. As Augustine said, we love the truth when it enlightens us. We hate the truth when it convicts us. So don't buy into this idea you can't make judgments. Don't buy into this idea there is no truth. That's a truth claim. In fact, the thing I really want to communicate in this section is this. Can everybody see that this statement and others like it shoot themselves? Can you see that? To say there's no truth is a truth claim. So relativism and postmodernism are false because they say it's true, there's no truth. So the next, and by the way, we just covered two chapters of the book right there, okay? Now we're moving on to the next question, does God exist? And this is about four chapters we're going to cover in the next 8 minutes, all right? Does God exist? We know the truth exists. Is it true that God exists? Three arguments for the existence of a theistic God. The first is from the beginning of the universe, known as the cosmological argument. Cosmological is a Greek word or comes from the Greek word cosmos, which means world or universe. It says if the universe had a beginning, it must have had a beginner. The second argument is the argument from design, known as the teleological argument. Telos is a Greek word meaning design or purpose. And it says if there's design in the universe and design in you, there must be a designer. These are arguments that have scientific evidence behind them, but this last argument doesn't have scientific evidence behind it. Yet it's the argument that we've known since we were very small children. It's the argument from morality known as the moral argument. We covered some of that last night. Let's start right here at point one, though. The first argument, the argument from the beginning of the universe, which many say points back to the big... Now, some of you are going, Frank, you know, we're Christians in here. We don't believe in the Big Bang. You guys don't believe in the Big Bang? I believe in the Big Bang. I just know who banged it. In fact, the evidence for the Big Bang is so good, you even have atheistic scientists admitting it, like Stephen Hawking, who says almost everyone now believes that the universe and time itself had a beginning at the Big Bang. Now, Hawking, the famous physicist, tries to come up with another explanation for how space, matter, and time could have a beginning without God. He fails, but he's admitting the data. What's the data? That space, matter, and time had a beginning. Now think about this. I'm not even going to show you the evidence for this because it's not controversial. The atheists are already admitting it. If you want the evidence, it's in chapter 3 of the book. But look, if space, matter, and time had a beginning, whatever created space, matter, and time can't be made of space, matter, and time, right? In other words, the cause must be spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful to create the universe out of nothing, personal in order to choose to create, because only persons make choices, and in order to create something, you have to make a choice. Also intelligent, because we'll see here in a minute, the universe is designed, and so are you. Now, when you think about a spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful, personal, intelligent cause, who do you think of? That's what we mean by God. Now, we're not opening the Bible to get this information. It is in the Bible, but you don't need the Bible to know this. The second argument is the argument from the design of the universe and the design of life known as the teleological argument. And with regard to the universe appears to be designed. This is an argument called fine-tuning. It's only been around for 50 or 60 years, and it shows that the universe appears to have a number of factors about it, environmental factors about it, constants in the laws of nature, that are precisely tweaked to be just what they are, that if you were to change any one of them virtually imperceptibly, there would be no universe. We'll go back to the atheist Stephen Hawking, because he'll tell us about the expansion rate of the universe. And here's what he says. He says, if the expansion rate of the universe was different by one part in a thousand million million a second after the Big Bang, the universe would have collapsed back on itself or never developed galaxies. So if the universe expansion rate was infinitesimally different, we wouldn't be here. Now, what explains that? Well, you can't make any evolutionary argument for this. Why? Because these are the initial conditions of the universe. The same being that created space, matter, and time appears to be the same intelligent being that tweaked the expansion rate to be exactly what it should be for us to be here. And this is just one of scores of these kinds of factors about our universe or constants about our universe. Change any one of them and we're not here. That appears to be the product of design. Not only is the universe designed, so are you. This is in the womb at 11 weeks. Question, is this animal, mineral, vegetable, or human? That's human. In fact, let's go back even further than 11 weeks. Let's go back to when your mother and your father got together to conceive you. Have you guys had this talk before? I see some young people in here, so I'll try and be discreet. I also see some older people in here, so I'll try and be discreet as well, just in case you've forgotten how this works. When your mother and your father got together to conceive you, your mother unconsciously perfumed her egg. And then your father sent the entire population of the United States, 300 million soldiers, toward your mother's egg, and then there was a race, and you won. Don't let anyone ever tell you you're not special. You beat out 300 million others. You have blown away anything Michael Phelps has done. Now, seeing some of you limp in here earlier makes it hard for me to believe you were the fastest soldier in the gene pool, but you were. Now, your soldier was 20 to 30 times smaller than a grain of salt, yet it contained half of the genetic information that makes you you, the half of the 3.5 billion letter genome that makes you you. And your mother's egg was about the size of a period at the end of a sentence in an average book, and it contained the other half of the genetic information that makes you you, the 3.5 billion letter genome. And when your soldier and your egg came together, a new 100% genetic human being was created. Do you know you have not received any more genetic information from that point till right now? Your genetic information has just duplicated itself. In fact, there were only four things separating you from adulthood: time, air, water, and food. Those are the same four things that separate a two-year-old from adulthood. Does this have implications on the abortion issue? Yeah, I think it does. We don't kill the two-year-old. Why do we kill the unborn child in the womb? Genetically, it's the same. You say, Frank, come on, you can't legislate morality. No extra charge for this, ladies and gentlemen. All laws legislate morality. The only question is whose morality will be legislated. And I'm not saying you ought to legislate my morality or your morality. We ought to legislate the morality. The one in our country, Thomas Jefferson said, was self-evident. The same law that the Apostle Paul said, the Gentiles who do not have the law have the law written on their hearts. Everybody intuitively knows there's a right to life. In fact, the right to life is the right to all other rights. If you don't have life, you don't have anything. All right, no extra charge for that. Let's go back to this. from this point till right now, a construction project of astonishing complexity began taking place. Cells began multiplying at a rate of 4,000 cells per second. Brain cells began multiplying at a rate of 100,000 cells per second. For most of you, anyway. Some cells became heart cells, others brain cells, others lung cells. How did they know how to do this? Nobody knows. Some cells went so far across you to become what it needed to become that it would be equivalent to you today walking across Canada alone. And that construction project continues to this day. You just made 4 million new red blood cells. You just made another 4 million new red blood cells. You just made another 4 million new red blood cells. Knock it off. Now, are you thinking about this? Are you going, hold on, Frank, got to concentrate. New red blood cells coming up. No, then how is all this happening? You're not even thinking about it. How is it happening? Have you noticed that nature goes in a direction? That acorns always become oak trees, and puppies always become dogs, and babies always become adults if properly nourished? Why is that? Why do things go in a direction? Even things that don't have a mind, like an acorn to an oak tree. Because if it doesn't have its own mind, there must be an external mind directing it. This is what Aristotle called final causality, that things are going toward a final end, a final goal. Thomas Aquinas took that in the 1200s and baptized it and said, this is going to be my fifth way to argue for God. All of nature is going in a direction, and yet much of nature doesn't have a mind. If it doesn't have a mind, there must be an external mind directing it. That's what we mean by God. This is why the writer of Hebrews says that God sustains all things by his powerful word. Paul says, in him we live and move and have our being. Christ holds all things together. In fact, God is to the universe what a band is to music. When the band was up here playing music, the band was creating and sustaining the music. What happened to the music the second the band stopped playing? Music's over. Same thing is true with God. God creates the universe and he sustains the universe. If he were to pull his hand away from the universe, we'd go out of existence. Who's keeping these natural laws that govern the universe going in a consistent direction? There's a mind out there doing that. That's what we mean by God. Now, there's a lot more in the book on that. The third argument is the argument from morality, which we talked about last night. When we said, is there a true moral compass out there, or does the compass always point to you? Do you get to determine what right and wrong is, or do you discover what right and wrong is? And I gave you the example last night of poor Jessica Mitzel, the young girl who had been sexually abused for 10 years, who wrote her own book on it called Not Your Princess. And we said that if this is evil, and everyone in here knows it is, then there must be a standard of good out there. Which is what we mean by God's nature. If there is no God, you can't say what that 50-year-old man to Jessica Mitzel was really wrong. It's just your opinion. If there is no God, you can't say the Holocaust was really wrong. You can't say rape is wrong, or murder is wrong, or slavery is wrong, or whatever. There's nothing wrong with anything unless there's a standard of good out there to which we're obligated. Everyone in here knows there are certain things that are really right and other things that are really wrong. If that's the case, God exists. In fact, God's nature is the standard of goodness that we're obligated to keep. Life's moral compass is his nature. Now, if you put these three arguments together, the cosmological, teleological, and moral arguments, you get a spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful, personal, intelligent, moral, sustaining creator who created all things and sustains all things to this very minute. We haven't even opened the Bible yet. And we have a God that looks like the God of the Bible. Now, does this mean that the God of the Bible is true? Not necessarily. This could be some other theistic God. This could just be the God of the Old Testament. Or maybe it's Allah. Right? We don't know yet. Actually, it can't be Allah. Why not? Because as even Muslims admit, Allah is morally arbitrary. Whatever Allah does is good. He's not essentially good. Whatever he does is good. Well, we know there's a standard of goodness out there. So Allah is not a candidate. But we don't know if it's Jesus either. So what are we going to do to figure out who the true God is? If God wanted to tell us who the true God is, what could he do? He could do something only he could do, and that would be a miracle. Because miracles can confirm a message from God. Why do people believe in Moses? Because Moses can do miracles. How about Jesus and the apostles? Because they can do miracles. God is doing miracles through them to tell human beings, you ought to listen to these people. That's my signal that what they're telling you is the truth. Now, here's the problem with miracles. A lot of people believe miracles are not possible. Like, how can you believe in Noah? That just seems crazy. Come on, Noah and the ark, please. How can you believe in a resurrection? Everyone I know who's dead is still dead. You know anybody who's resurrected from the dead? Nope, neither have I. Why would you believe in a resurrection? Well, for some reason, the big problem miracle in the Bible is Jonah. Is that a tail of a whale or a whale of a tail? What's the deal with Jonah? How can you believe in Jonah? Well, ladies and gentlemen, let me ask you a question. What is the greatest miracle in the Bible? What is it? It's not the resurrection. The resurrection's easy compared to the greatest miracle. This is the interactive portion of the program. Yes, the greatest miracle in the Bible is the first verse. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. If that verse is true, every other verse is at least possible, right? I mean, if it's true that God created the heavens and the earth out of nothing, can he do whatever he wants? It's not logically impossible inside the heavens and the earth? Of course, if he can create the whole show out of nothing, can he raise Jesus from the dead? Can he walk on water? He created water. Can he do the Jonah miracle, the Noah miracle? He can do any of these things if the first verse of the Bible is true. Well, here's the interesting part. We actually have good evidence the first verse of the Bible is true. Even atheists are admitting it. Well, if the first verse is true, maybe these other verses are true. You just can't rule it out, as so many tend to do. And by the way, a lot of people won't believe in miracles because they've never seen one. Now, that's a bad reason not to believe in something. Why? Because you believe in a lot of things you've never seen. You believe in your mind. You've never seen it. You're using it right now. You believe in the laws of logic. You've never seen those. You're using them right now. You believe in gravity. You've never seen gravity. You go, Frank, sure I have. Look at that. There's gravity right there. No, no, no. You're not seeing gravity. You're seeing the effects of gravity. We really don't even know what gravity is. You're just seeing its effects. And that's how we know God exists. We know God by his effects. We see a creation, we know there must be a creator. We know there's a moral law written on our hearts, there must be a moral lawgiver. We're reasoning from effect back to cause. And even though you can't see it, you can see the effects. In fact, you believe in historical figures like George Washington. You've never seen him, but you believe in him. There's a lot of things that you believe in you've never seen. And in fact, you shouldn't expect to see a lot of miracles. Why? Miracles, by definition, have to be rare events. If miracles were occurring all the time, they wouldn't get our attention. We'd say, oh, this is just regular phenomenon. This stuff happens all the time. It's no big deal. Miracles have to be rare if they're going to get our attention. They only make sense against the backdrop of regular natural laws. In fact, if people were rising from the dead routinely, what would the resurrection of Christ mean to us? Nothing. Right? You go to somebody and you go, Jesus rose from the dead for your sins. And the guy goes, so what? Uncle Leroy just rose from the dead 2 weeks ago. Now I got to give the inheritance back. Right? No. Miracles have to be rare. You're not going to see a lot of miracles because if they happened all the time, we'd think there's some sort of natural event. Now, there's a lot more in the book on miracles, but we got to move on to the key question, and that is the New Testament true? We know the truth exists. We know that God exists. We know that miracles are possible. The only question is, have miracles since the creation of the universe occurred, like the resurrection of Jesus? Has that occurred? Now, in the book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, there's a chapter in there called The Top 10 Reasons We Know the New Testament Writers Told the Truth. I don't have time to cover them. I'm just going to briefly look at two of them. One of them is what we call embarrassing stories. This is telling me they're not making this up. What are embarrassing stories? If there's something embarrassing in the text to the author or authors, it's probably true. Why? You're never going to invent embarrassing details about yourself, right? If you have an embarrassing, if you do something privately that's embarrassing, you're probably not even going to tell anybody about it, right? You're certainly not going to invent embarrassing details about yourself. In fact, let me ask the question this way. How many people in here have ever lied to make yourself look good? If you don't have your hand up right now, you're lying to make yourself look good. And it's not working. We know you're lying. All right, how many people in here have ever lied to make yourself look bad? In other words, to embarrass yourself. You don't do that, right? Well, the New Testament writers have filled the documents with embarrassing details about themselves and even potentially about Jesus. By the way, this is true of the Old Testament as well, but we're just going to look at the New. And that's why we know they're not making it up. They're just not making this up because they never would do this. Let me just give you a few examples. Notice that the New Testament writers depict themselves as dim-witted. They fail to understand what Jesus is saying. They don't even get his mission until he's already resurrected and ascended to heaven. And then they go, wow, I could have had a V8, right? But up to that point, they don't even get it. And then their leader, Peter, is called Satan by Jesus. Do you think they invented this? Do you think Mark, who wrote this down at one point, said to Peter, hey, Pete, I'm going to make this a real interesting story. I'm going to have the Lord call you Satan. What do you think Peter would have said? Have him call you Satan. Why is he calling me Satan? Look, I'm the leader here. This is embarrassing. And then later on, Peter says, I'll never deny you, Lord. What does he wind up doing? He winds up denying him three times. That's embarrassing. He's their leader. And then at the crucifixion, the disciples run away. This is like a Monty Python movie. Run away! They all run away. And who are the brave ones? The women. That's right. The women are the brave ones. Now, who wrote this down? Men. Now, what man is going to invent that he was hiding for fear of the Jews, why the women went down and discovered the empty tomb? Would any man in here invent that? I mean, if I was inventing this story, I'd write something down like this. Let's see. We marched right down there and overpowered that elite Roman guard. Yeah, that sounds good. John said to them, get out. Peter, roundhouse kicked them. Philip said, we'll be back. And then on Sunday morning, we marched right down to the tomb, and we saw Jesus emerging from the tomb.
And then he congratulated us on our great faith.
And then we went and comforted the trembling women.
I would never say I was Mr. Sissy Pants. Why the women went down and discovered the empty tomb. And oh, by the way, why would you never say the women were the first witnesses in that culture? Because a woman's testimony was not considered on par with that of a man. So if you were inventing this whole thing, you'd only have the men be the first witnesses. Yet all four Gospels say the women were the first witnesses, which is telling us what? They really were. They had no motive to say the women were the first witnesses. It's embarrassing in that culture. I actually had a woman come up to me once and she said, I know why Jesus appeared to the women first. I said, why? And she said, because he wanted to get the story out. I said, that is an excellent point. I had not thought of that because, ladies, when your man comes home from work, does he say much? There could have been a nuclear explosion down at the plant. He's not going to tell you. You'll see it on the news before you hear it from him. You'll be watching the news and you'll be going, hey, hon, what the? Oh, yeah, I forgot to tell you. The nuke blew up a few days ago. I've been hot for 3 days. Hey, what's for dinner? You know, he's not going to tell you. He's just not. Oh, by the way, there's even embarrassing details potentially about Jesus in there. Do you know his own family thinks he's out of his mind? In Mark chapter 3, they want to seize him and take him home because they think he's nuts. You think they're inventing this? Jesus is called demon-possessed. He's called a drunkard. Think they invented all this? He has his feet wiped with the hair of a prostitute, which easily could have been seen as a sexual advance. And oh, by the way, you know there are two prostitutes in Jesus' bloodline? Who are they? Rahab and Tamar. Do you think Matthew and Luke got together at one point and said, you know what, I really think we need to spice up the Messiah's bloodline a little bit. Let's put a couple of prostitutes in there. Let's see, Rahab, Tamar, the Kardashians. No, let's not put them out. That would go too far. No, they're not inventing this. In fact, there's a lot of shady people in Jesus' bloodline. Judah, from where we get the term Jew from, bad guy. David's in there. He's a liar, adulterer, and a murderer, yet he's a man after God's own heart. Gee, I guess there's hope for the rest of us, huh? Bathsheba's in there. One of the writers won't even mention her name. You know what he says in the genealogy about Bathsheba? Uriah's wife. Ooh, that's a slam, isn't it? I mean, he's telling the truth. It is Uriah's wife. Who is Uriah? Husband of Bathsheba, whom David had killed. But if you're inventing this, you wouldn't say that. Do you think any pharaoh would have these embarrassing details in his bloodline? No, he would chop the heads off of his historian. You don't find that kind of thing in the Bible. You don't find everything pure as the driven snow. You find all the characters and the supposed heroes in the Bible to be faulty people who need a savior. It's embarrassing, but they're telling the truth. They never would have invented this. One more piece of evidence that they're telling the truth are excruciating deaths. This is a painting of Peter being crucified upside down. Now keep in mind that every one of the New Testament writers, with the exception of Luke, was a Jew. They already thought they were God's chosen people. They had no motive to make up a resurrection story. What motive would they have to make up a risen Jesus? What did it get them? They got excommunicated from the synagogue, and then they got beaten, tortured, and killed. Last time I checked, that was not a list of perks, right? Hey, we're going to start a new religion. We are? Yeah. What's it going to get us? Well, first we'll get kicked out of the synagogue, and then we'll get beaten, tortured, and killed. Well, sign me up! You know, what a great idea. Why haven't we thought of this earlier? No, I don't think so. They had every motive to say the resurrection did not happen, not every motive to say it did. Yet they went to their deaths saying it did. Why? Because it really happened. There's no reason to make this up. They're Jews. They thought they were God's chosen people. Now, you might be thinking, wait a minute, Frank, are you telling me that martyrdom proves Christianity? Because if it does, don't you have to say martyrdom proves Islam? Because they have martyrs too. No, why? There's a lot of differences between the Muslim martyrs of today and the New Testament martyrs of New Testament times. Well, let me just give you the main difference for our purposes here. The Muslim martyrs don't have evidence that Islam is true. They just have faith. But the New Testament martyrs, they were in a position to know whether Jesus had risen from the dead. They saw Jesus. They touched Jesus. They ate with Jesus. They verified with their own senses Jesus had risen from the dead. You see, many people will die for a lie they think is the truth, like many Muslims will. But nobody will die for a lie they know is a lie. And the New Testament martyrs were in a position to know whether it was a lie or not, and they went to their deaths anyway. You can't get better evidence than that unless you were there yourself. So the conclusion of this is the New Testament historically reliable? Let me put it this way. The New Testament writers did not create the resurrection. The resurrection created the New Testament writers. You know there would be no New Testament without the resurrection? Think about it. Do you realize that there were thousands of Christians before a line of the New Testament was ever written? Why? Because Christianity is not based on what a book says. Christianity is based on an event. An historical event, the resurrection of Jesus. If Jesus never rose from the dead, then Christianity's dead. As Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, there would be no New Testament if it wasn't for a resurrection. They wrote it down because Jesus rose from the dead. They didn't invent a resurrected Jesus and by writing it down. It really happened. That's the point. Now, what's the overall big picture? Does truth exist? The answer is, what if somebody says there is no truth? You're going to say what? Is that true? All right. Does God exist? What's the evidence? What's the first piece of evidence we looked at? The argument. The cosmological argument, the beginning of the universe. The second argument, teleological or design argument. Third, moral. When you put those three arguments together, you get a spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful, moral, personal, intelligent creator who sustains all things. Are miracles possible? What's the greatest miracle in the Bible? The first verse. If the first verse is true, then maybe the other verses are true. We now have atheists admitting it appears the first verse is true. Now, they don't say it's God, but if space, matter, and time had a beginning, what's your option? None other, it seems to me, than a spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful, personal, intelligent creator. Is the New Testament reliable? Is it true? Does it tell you the truth about the resurrection? There would be no New Testament if the resurrection didn't occur. And the evidence shows that they had elements in that text that shows they are telling the truth. Embarrassing stories, excruciating deaths, and many others you can see about in the book. So if you want to go further, you can get the book back there. The DVD's out of our website. Again, if you want this PowerPoint presentation, a lot longer than the one I've actually showed you in a PDF form, you just got to type that into your browser. We'll send it to you. Send us an email. We'll send it to you. Don't forget, we're on YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook. The two Facebook pages you need to like. Crossexamined.org and Dr. Frank Turek. We're streaming our college events now live, and so if you want to see any of those, particularly the Q&A, you have to like the page or you won't get the notification when we're doing it. All right, we're on radio Saturdays, that's podcasted. We're on DirecTV Wednesday nights. You can get that on the internet on our website, and at least get the free app. Again, the app, two words in the app store, Cross-Examined. Oh, I think we're over 121,000 downloads now, so people are finding it helpful. Don't forget about the quick answer section on there. That should be very helpful. Now, why do you want to do all this? Because you don't want this happening to you, your child, or your grandchild. Because if you leave Christianity, you're not neutral. You've just adopted another faith. Another faith that has a lot less evidence than the Christian faith. So, we only have 54 seconds to go. So that means that you have an extra now 49 seconds to take a break, because you're going to be back in here. We'll all be back in here at 2:30. All right? See you then.